Les séminaires du Collège de France.
Et donc maintenant, j'ai le grand plaisir de vous présenter notre intervenant suivant. La présentation a été déjà partiellement faite indirectement par Gunnel, puisque vous avez vu sur l'écran des photos de Jake Morton, ce qui montre évidemment la complémentarité des profils. Alors, juste deux mots sur le parcours original de notre deuxième intervenant. Donc depuis 2018, Jake Morton est professeur associé en Classics au Carleton College aux États-Unis. Alors il avait obtenu une thèse de doctorat à l'Université de Pennsylvanie et j'ai envie de dire qu'à l'époque il était un historien classique. C'est-à-dire que la thèse portait sur des questions de topographie en lien avec l'arrivée des Romains en Grèce. Donc quelque chose d'histoire institutionnelle, événementielle, guerrière, mais la passion de la religion, de la religion grecque, était déjà là. Et Jake a ceci son parcours a ceci de particulier et d'intéressant, qu'il a d'abord, avant cette conversion vers l'Antiquité, été chef. Et un chef qui a dû s'initier à des techniques de boucherie. Bon, c'est important pour la suite, parce qu'à partir du moment où cette thèse a été faite en Pennsylvanie et où l'intérêt pour les questions, je dirais, de sacrifice s'est imposé peu à peu dans son parcours. Il a notamment travaillé à l'école américaine à Athènes où il a commencé à faire des expérimentations de l'archéologie expérimentale. Et aujourd'hui, ses étudiants ont la grande chance d'avoir, je ne sais pas à quelle périodicité, mais des cours d'expérimentation archéologique, c'est-à-dire qu'à Carleton College on fait des sacrifices, ce qui est quand même extraordinaire. Et donc c'est évidemment la raison pour laquelle je voulais absolument que vous ayez l'occasion d'entendre Jake parler de sa recherche, voir aussi toutes les choses extraordinaires qu'il nous a apportées et qu'il nous réserve. Et donc, je vais lui passer immédiatement la parole. Et puis, nous pourrons ensuite discuter de cette double vision du sacrifice autour des deux communications. Jake, the floor is yours.
Merci. Thank you all so much. It is such an honor to be here. This paper arose from my... Is that too loud? Okay. It feels really loud up here, sorry. This paper arose from my interest in the ancient Greek practice of butchering and cooking sacrificial victims at religious festivals before they went into rigor mortis, a practice today called hot cutting. This is not how butchery is done in the United States or anywhere I've ever been, where butchery is always done after hanging the animal for at least 24 hours to allow it to pass through the stages of rigor mortis. This paper then explores the different and varied findings concerning the realities of slaughter, butchery, and cooking that came out of this project over the past 5 years of research. And the core of this research is an annual experimental archaeological project I've been conducting for 5 years in which I hold an attempted reconstruction or reenactment of an ancient Greek sacrificial ritual at a farm where I live in Minnesota. Where's my... The Temenos is right there, if you can, all right. In partnership with local shepherds and farmers, I slaughter two lambs and then skin, gut, and butcher them to study ancient techniques, and then hold a big feast with the community involving everyone in the ancient rites around the altar. And I focus on different research questions each year. Now, and this project works in tandem with close study of ancient art and ancient texts and archaeological remains, comparative study of shepherds across space and time, slaughter techniques and butchery techniques, interviews with shepherds, slaughterers, and butchers, and my own background cooking and fine dining, as you mentioned, for 10 years before I went to graduate school. This isn't going to be just a detailed step-by-step of the animal through sacrificial ritual, but more a focus of the new concepts of things I've discovered and found interesting. If there's things I've left out or that you'd like to discuss later, there's literally nothing I'd rather do. And I'm in Paris for another 2 days, should the spirit mind move anybody. In the goal of working in tandem with Professor Eckroth's paper on bones, this paper will attempt to explore the parts of the sacrificial victim that are not bones. Okay, so I want to step back for a second, though, and look at who did this work with the sacrificial animal at ritual sacrifices. And it can be hard to tell from vase images like this if different jobs during the ritual had different dedicated people doing them. And Plato, in the dialogue Euthydemus, has Socrates ask, who is it who slaughters skins, cuts into smaller pieces, and then boils or roasts? To which his interlocutor says, the maieros. He's correct. All right, and this indicates for us that one person could be responsible for all the steps of sacrificial ritual having to do with processing the carcass, rather than a team of specialists. Or at least this one man had the skill set to do each of the steps, and that he importantly dealt with whole animals rather than merely or primarily breaking down smaller cuts, like is pictured here, right? He's got an entire back leg that he's parting into smaller pieces. But apparently he started with a whole animal. Plato also understood that this was a well-understood profession in contemporary Greek society, as he has Socrates mention the maieros in 9 works as a profession with which to make an analogy alongside other professions, such as in the Gorgias, cobblers, fullers, doctors, and farmers. And Socrates' maieros is understood to have a specific field of knowledge in which they have authority, just like a doctor, farmer, musician, or wrestler, and could write a treatise on their profession, like a doctor, farmer, or gardener. So to sum up, Socrates' analogies require his audience to understand that the maieros is a skilled professional able to do each of the steps that I'm interested in today: slaughter, skinning, butchering, and cooking. But now let's turn to the sacrificial ritual. And I'll begin with slaughter. The most important concept here seems to have a smoothly operating event with a calm animal and a controlled, predictable, uneventful kill. Unlike, say, the famous and rather unauspicious scene in the Aeneid Book 2 passage where the bull breaks loose and runs around with an axe still lodged in the back of its neck. But it doesn't have to be so extreme. I would imagine any aspect of animal panic or extremely difficult behavior would seem inauspicious. And so for this, the focus would then be on keeping the animal's stress level as low as possible. For here, I'm going to turn to Temple Grandin. Do you guys know who Temple Grandin is? Is this a name I can use? Okay, she's the foremost authority in meat science in the world. And if you know, okay, she's fantastic. She's really worth looking into. And if you're interested in a meat science approach, she is the foremost. There is no number two, okay? She's deeply autistic and takes on the role of animals and moves through their areas to study them. Truly brilliant, brilliant stuff. So she's done the most work on pre-slaughter stress in herd animals. Pre-slaughter stress in sheep, goats, cattle, and pigs is divided into 2 categories: chronic long-term stress and short-term stress immediately prior to slaughter. And I'm arguing that ancient shepherding practices serve to reduce these stressors. Starting with long-term stress, major factors include excessive herd size, opportunity for exercise, having the same shepherd or shepherds around the animals daily, having the shepherd or shepherds touch the animals daily, and a healthy diet. Now, while we know Jason of Fair Eye assembled a herd of 10,000 sheep to parade to Delphi in 370, this was a remarkable event. All right, and herd sizes are not thought to be on the scale of industrial farming practices in the United States, for whom these modern meat science studies are done. All traditional shepherds walk their sheep during the day. Only in modern industrial farming do they keep the animals confined, which increases stress level. The shepherd was always understood to spend tremendous time with his animals, as mentions in ancient sources and pre-modern studies make clear, and the constant touching is seen in pre-modern studies, as well as ancient sources. Think Polyphemus being able to recognize all his sheep by touch alone. A healthy diet is understood to be a pasturing diet where modern organic shepherds will tell you the animals regulate their own diet to keep their guts healthy. Regarding short-term stress immediately prior to slaughter, major factors include stress during travel to the slaughter site and having the shepherd the herd knows present. For stress in general, vision is the most important sense, as hearing and smell do not cause stress in a similar fashion. The causes of stress during travel to the slaughter site involve mixing with unknown animals, handling by unknown humans, and poor ventilation, humidity, and temperature in the transit vehicles. We see in Odyssey 3 when Nestor calls for a cowherd to personally bring a bovine to the palace, the understanding that the cowherd or shepherd would accompany their own animal to slaughter. Pre-modern sources indicate that shepherds always understood the stress involved with mixing herds, and you see this discussed when they talk about beginning their seasonal transhuman journeys and mixed herds come together and all the chaos that ensues. Since ancient shepherds walked their sheep to temple sites for slaughter, the stress factors from truck travel are removed. Modern small-scale shepherding practices in rural Minnesota, where I live, aim to reduce these same stress factors in similar ways, making these practices and these sheep, I feel, a working proxy for ancient practice. Temple Grandin asserts that an absence of long-term stresses make the animal more resistant to short-term stresses pre-slaughter, and my experience supports this. This is the chute, all right, that we put the lamb in, and we did not used to have this piece here, let me tell you. And out of that little hole right there, a sheep took off once and made it out of that hole and made it two farms down the road before we caught it. And then we cornered it, and these guys are tough. He figured out in the circle who the weak link was and then just took them out. And they know what's going on. And so finally the shepherd yelled in frustration with us weaklings, tackle it like a football player. And this large man did. There he is celebrating. So he tackled this sheep, and so you would imagine this is a deeply high stressful environment, but the sheep had run so far that we brought a pickup truck at this point to take it back. And the shepherd, though, this man, who's been with the sheep every day, was there, and he took the sheep into the back of the pickup truck, and the sheep was so calm and happy to be there with him, and we got him back to the truck and gave him a little bit of lairage for about 30 minutes to relax, and at slaughter he could not have been more calm. So I think his previous life without stress allowed him to absorb this pre-slaughter stress as if it was nothing. Okay? Well, you don't have to look at Joe celebrating anymore. We'll go back to Jake. Temple Grandin has studied that vision is the sense that causes the most stress in animals used in sacrifice in ancient Greece, and smelling or hearing the slaughter of the... So due to this importance of vision for stress, Jeremy McInerney's proposed cattle chutes on the Acropolis, in other words, that right here are these post holes, and that these post holes held cattle chutes, I think it would have reduced stress, and it makes sense of such a large sacrifice. What I'm not sure about, and I would love to, theorize more about this, is how these sites with multiple bull rings in front of an altar helped keep vision stress to a minimum. So the image on the left is a grid of 20 bull rings in front of an altar at Dion in Macedonia with one student standing on each ring. And on the right is two of four originally excavated bull rings in front of an altar at the theater at Demetrius in Thessaly. So I wonder if additional wickerwork screens, like used on the Acropolis or proposed on the Acropolis, were used here to reduce vision, or if maybe their heads were pulled down to keep them from seeing. I don't know. So something just to throw out there that I'd love to know more about. But back to our festival. In the United States, the law is that one must make an animal insensate before slaughter by cutting its throat, and we do that with a gunshot wound to the forehead. This concept is the same as was used on cattle slaughter in the ancient world, with a strike at the back of the neck causing the animal to become insensate before cutting its throat. For lamb and goat slaughter in ancient Greece, we understood there not to have been the stunning blow, but the throat to have been cut in a single clean motion, much like modern day kosher or halal slaughter. The step immediately after slaughter is exsanguination, the bleeding out of the animal. And this is a remarkably fast process, only in a couple minutes. One needs to immediately stir the blood to keep it from coagulating so it can be used for rituals at the altar or for eating, whether in stews or sausages. And this stirring phase, maybe 2 minutes. For the tool used for this stirring, I'd like to suggest that the same tool picked here, or a derivative smaller version of this tool that's used to traditionally stir milk by shepherds during the cheesemaking process, might have been used, as this tool would have been familiar to shepherds. Okay? This tool, though, would leave no trace in the archaeological record. It's just a proposal. And after the initial stirring of less than 5 minutes, the blood will maintain this consistency and not coagulate again until needed, as long as you would. It's just one time. Once the animal is slaughtered and bled, the next step is skinning. And our first question is whether animals were skinned on tables, cradle tables, or hung. Images depicted on classical vases do depict carcasses on tables. And a late Bronze Age glyptic does seem to depict an animal carcass on a cradle table, and a modern cradle table is depicted here. It has no top, and it seems to be depicted in this glyptic as well. And while I've worked with cradle tables to explore how they worked and that they do, and skinning on cradle tables is a common practice today, I will say that gravity does make skinning hanging animals easier. And so I wonder if there was a structure sometimes used, like this pre-modern tripod for hanging carcasses for skinning in rural Minnesota, that would leave no trace in the archaeological record, or if smaller animals such as lambs could have been hung on trees. This paper, as experimental archaeology, has a lot of non-archaeological evidence proposals out there. So, I do want to quickly, now I'll return to the images of animals on tables. Images of animals having their organs removed while they still have their skins is not depicting ancient practice. One always removes the skin before opening up the carcass, unless one does not plan on eating the meat. So these images are either getting the concept of organ removal across to the viewer, or they're perhaps making clear the specific animal involved, or these special horns, okay? For hanging the carcass, the first step is to pierce the gambrel or Achilles tendons of the hind legs and then hang it. One can use a small knife for skinning, okay? And in fact, if one is concerned about keeping the sheepskin as free from holes as possible, and the common use of sheepskins as a geras in sacred laws would indicate the importance of the sheepskin, one commonly uses one's fist actually to remove the skin in pre-modern practice and today, not a knife once you've started. So less knife skills and a smaller knife are required for this stage than perhaps people expect. One additional quick proposal, if I may, here's a skinned, half-skinned animal, is that there is a tool used today to skin the tail, this tail zipper. If you notice, it's a back-turned blade. And it makes me wonder if a similar small curved hook or sharpened hook, like a falks, for pruning trees that you see in museums might have been used. And in fact, yesterday, Gunnel and I were at the Musée de Cluny, and I saw one on a tapestry and was very excited. So took this picture, said, this is exactly the tool I'm talking about. So I wonder if something like this was used to skin the tail. And the reason that you would do that or have a specialized tool rather than just using whatever knife you used is it is difficult to carefully skin a tail without breaking the delicate string of small vertebrate bones. And you need those vertebrate bones unbroken for the ritual at the altar that Gunnel was talking about. So I, something that farmers would have been known about. Maybe they could have used it. All right, let's look at the removed sheepskin. There is a need for immediate salting of the inside of this hide to begin the lengthy process of tanning the inside of the sheepskin. So this points to perhaps a different process on site than I'd originally realized when we read in sacred laws of the fleece being a geras to someone. It's not like they are just grabbing it and taking it home to use. Here's your sheepskin. Go take it home. It needs to be salted immediately, laid out flat, and then the tanning process takes months. So in a major sacrifice of many animals, say 30 animals, 40 animals, this mental image suddenly of a field of skins with 2 centimeters of salt on each one for that first 24 hours to get the cure going of the skin so it doesn't go in rancid, which gives a different mental image to me than I ever had of the area around a festival site. And what this fleece looks like could vary as well, the extremes being bare leather and a fully fleeced jacket for working shepherds, which you've probably seen from Greece. In other words, was the wool shorn at not at all, some or completely, before it was skinned, would really change what this garros meant. It could be so much, okay? I'm fascinated by what a varied product this could be. So in the skinning phase, the head and hooves are also removed. The head could become a bucranium, which I have not yet experienced on, so I'm not really going to comment on it. But on the other hand, you can cook it, my preferred method, to get the brain, cheeks, and tongue. But I'm more interested in the hooves. The lower section of the leg together with the hoof is removed, and in Minnesota, these are set aside always to be given to the shepherd's dogs. And in a wonderful bit of things not changing across space and time, François Le Sarag has convincingly argued that dogs gnawing on this same body part is depicted in these ancient Athenian vase images. And so now we'll move to guts. Well, first one has to cut off and tie the exit of the intestinal tract from the carcass. And once you've done that, you have to cut carefully at the initial stage of opening up the abdominal cavity to keep from piercing the digestive tract of organs and intestines, as this would get filth all over the meat. It's a very careful step right here. Upon opening the abdominal cavity, one immediately sees the omentum. So you saw this in Professor Eckroth's presentation, but there it is, an immediate opening. It's the first thing you see. So here it is coming out, and then there is it a little more close up. And there it is being removed. And as Gerhard Forstenpointer has convincingly argued that the omentum, if available, is what would be like this, used to wrap the thigh bones for the rituals at the altar, at the initial step, when you saw it here, and then when you removed it there, you would know if there was enough omentum, not guaranteed, to wrap the thigh bones, or if you needed to find an alternate fat source, such as from the thigh, somewhere else in the body, or a different victim's omentum to share with it right away. All right, the next step is to remove the digestive tract, including the rumen and the intestines. And while these are discarded today, we know that the stomach and intestines were used in the ancient world. We know of the stuffed stomachs going back to the Homeric metaphor of Odysseus rolling around before the fire like a stuffed stomach getting roasted. And we know that the intestines were used for sausage casings as well as potentially wrapping organs around the spit, a splanchna. However, the stomach and intestines being removed here could not be used in this sacrificial event, because they need to be cleaned with a time-intensive process. Okay. Behind the digestive tract, so here's the digestive tract being pulled to the side, and here you're seeing behind it are the kidneys, liver, back behind this there is the spleen, and there's the gallbladder. Okay. And once you have removed the kidney, spleen, liver, and gallbladder, there's a closer version of them all. Okay, here we go. Kidneys wrapped in a delicious layer of fat, spleen, liver, gallbladder. And beneath them, once you've removed those, you have your diaphragm, okay? However, what you could do, we're at the splanchna, all right? The organs roasted over the altar and eaten. This is the liver, kidneys, heart, and possibly lungs. While here I just removed some of the splanchna, you can remove all of them but the kidneys at once, okay, with a single process. I just didn't do it in this picture. We're going to go through how it works now, all right? What you do is if at this stage you cut through the diaphragm, and here you reach past the diaphragm and then reach into the throat and grab the esophagus in your hand and pull the esophagus towards you, the lungs and heart will pop out attached to the esophagus in a single unit. And if you ever go to Central Market in Athens today, this is sold as a unit still, all right? Where you have the same, here's the heart and lungs, and they just got the meat through the heart But there's the heart, there's the lungs, heart and lungs. But they did it as one unit, so they kept the liver, okay, is attached to it, and there's the rest of that string. I sometimes refer to this as the organs on a string method. Here's another version of it being sold at the market with the intestines for sale right next to it. I like that they group them. They're selling them as this kind of combined units to sell. And the ancient understanding of this grouping of organs as a defined unit in the ancient world can be seen in this 3rd century BC Etruscan votive of the human version of this same set of organs. As someone there's had some sort of problem, is dedicated to a temple of Asclepius, all right, an Etruscan temple of Asclepius. Good, well, this is the thing I wanted to show you most today. I was very excited to show you this votive. That was returning to the organs. There can be great variation in their appearance depending, as one can imagine, on species, diet, and lifestyle. But perhaps more surprising is how different the organs can appear from the same herd with the same diet and lifestyle. So starting from the kidneys, and the kidneys are the one part of the splanchna that attach to the abdominal cavity and not to that string, the esophagus. We can see here such a wild difference in appearance and fat covering from two animals in the same herd. And moving to the heart, pictured there, I just want to point out that what you get out of the heart is how clean the kill went will be readily apparent by if the heart is full of clotted blood or not. Okay, so you'll know that right away, and that changes. And moving to the liver, here's the liver and the gallbladder and the abdominal cavity after the kidneys have been removed, and here is the liver being removed. Okay, the liver also shows great variance in color and appearance. This is two animals from the same herd. The liver often has spots that come in different patterns that shepherds around the Mediterranean found worthy of analysis. And interestingly, in my experience, all shepherds today always gather around the liver to examine its spots after slaughter. That's what's happening here. And they still read the liver. However, they use the spots to find out secret information about the lamb's past. They want to tell you about the lamb's diseases, secret traumas, or general health and spiritual happiness by reading the liver rather than tell you about humans' future. And so I just deeply love that in the modern world, the liver is still considered this source of hidden knowledge about the natural world that needs to be decoded by a specialist. So from the liver, we're going to move into the gallbladder. And to do this, please go with me. I'm going to have to do a bit more of a deep dive, and I promise I will return back to cooking splanchna. All right, so my initial interest into ancient sacrificial ritual revolved around the rites at the altar, and I'm deeply interested in this failed sacrifice scene in Sophocles' Antigone. In this passage, I'm sure you're all familiar with, Tiresias relates the details of a failed sacrificial ritual. At once I was alarmed, and I made trial of the burnt offering on the blazing altar, and out of the sacrifice Hephaestus did not shine, but over the embers the damp ooze was melting away from the thigh bones, smoking and spitting, and the gallbladder was scattered in the air, and the thighs were left bare of covering fat. Such things I learned from this boy. This description has been very influential in my research concerning the reality of what the fat-wrapped thigh bone does when placed on a burning altar, and how there is a tension built into the rite that is meant to succeed every time. So in total, at this point, I've burned 64 lamb thigh bones and 12 beef thigh bones. And I can tell you that as long as you wrap the thigh bone in sufficient fat, and that's at least 200 grams for a lamb thigh bone and 400 grams for beef, the wrapped thigh bone will always cause a distinct burst of flame when placed on the fire. This is a ritual designed to succeed so well that it would take divine intervention to make it fail, as seen in the Antigone passage. However, for roughly the first 2 to 4 minutes after the fat-wrapped thigh bone is put on the fire, it behaves like in the Antigone passage. The flames seem to diminish and the fat around the thigh bone starts sweating and spitting liquid as the temperature of the fat gets to 100 degrees Celsius and evaporates all of the liquid before it catches fire. And this behavior gives the distinct impression that the rite will fail, and then this tension leads to great relief for the witnesses when the thigh bone then does catch fire and the sustained burst of flame rises up. I will return to this at the end of the paper. This tension makes the ritual exciting, even though it works the same way every time. And this Antigone passage has been key for understanding, for me, how this tension works practically and how it was perceived in the ancient world. However, this bit about the gallbladder jars within this passage. putting a balloon full of liquid on a fire and thinking that this then exploding would be as rare or as impossible as a bone wrapped in fat not catching fire seems bizarre. Michael Jameson argued that this vase depicted this specific sacrifice scene from Antigone, with the central figure being Tiresias in the act of placing a gallbladder on the altar. And he based this argument on the idea that an image of his hand holding a beef gallbladder resembled the image depicted on a vase. However, it could all equally be depicting my hand holding a fat-wrapped lamb thigh bone. And this scene would then resemble a similar scene identified as a man placing a fat-wrapped thigh bone on an altar, here in a close-up. I started thinking that perhaps the Antigone passage was referencing a series of bad omens related to sacrifice, but not necessarily all taking place on the burning altar, and that perhaps this bad omen concerning the gallbladder refers to an event from the butchery phase. And this would make sense because if one nicks the gallbladder with one's knife during butchery, it could burst and it would shoot visibly green liquid everywhere that would need to get washed off because it gives a foully bitter taste, and this would seem auspicious, and a skilled butcher should never nick a gallbladder. And here is a picture of me nicking a gallbladder with my knife to show that it will spray an alarmingly green liquid everywhere. And while this could seem to make sense of the passage, it still jars because the omen would now seem to be based around the butcher's skill and not interference by the hand of God. And so that doesn't seem right either. And if we return to the Antigone passage and we place it in its larger context, in fact, whatever is happening with the gallbladder has to take place on the altar. The larger passage begins with Tiresias saying, "You will learn having heard the signs of my art." And it ends with Tiresias saying, "Thus I learn from the boy who guides me as I guide others." And within this framing, Tiresias discusses two sets of omens. And for each set, he first establishes that he was at the proper place to receive the omens before explaining how the omens he saw there went wrong in unexpected ways. So for the first set, Tiresias begins, "Sitting at my ancient seat for observing birds where I can mark every bird of omen," establishing that he was at the proper place. And then he relates the two examples of unexpected bad omens he perceived. First, "I heard an unknown sound of birds shrieking in ugly, unintelligible frenzy." And second, "I perceived them tearing each other with bloody talons. Indeed, the whirring of wings was not without meaning." So, at the place he can get omens from every bird, Tiresias gets two signs. One is unintelligible noises, and the other only tells him that the birds are attacking each other. And this combination leads him to say, "At once I was alarmed." And this seems reasonable, as he was not able to understand the sounds the birds made, which should be impossible. In his alarm, he attempts the rituals at the altar, apparently as a check on the first set of omens. Tiresias tells us that he is at the right place to read these signs, namely at an altar with a fire burning on it, which he placed a fat-wrapped thigh bone. And then we get four specifics. Fire did not come up from the fat-wrapped thigh bones. The fat around the thigh bones was melting, smoking, and spitting. The gallbladder burst into the air, and the thighs were bare of fat. Well, three of these four seem to give a distinct narrative of a fat-wrapped thigh bone that did not catch fire, but instead the fat melted away until the bone was there. The gallbladder bit seems confusingly jammed in the middle of this. Bayfield's 1950 Antigone commentary declares, "Well, the gallbladder placed upon the fat-wrapped thigh bone became slowly inflated by the heat and burst, scattering the gall. It should have been so rapidly consumed as to make this impossible." Bayfield seems to have determined this through internal evidence, the exploding gallbladder being directly associated with the thigh bone in the passage, and so placing the gallbladder on top of it seemed reasonable to him. But he offers no justification or evidence of how he came up with this explanation, and later commentaries do not include this interpretation, but they offer no new helpful interpretation either. Notably, Bayfield interprets the passage to mean that the quality of the omen is indicated by whether or not the gallbladder explodes. A striking aspect of this gallbladder line is Sophocles' use of the plural coli. Coli is the nominative plural of colae, which means gall or gallbladder, and this is a rare form used only in this passage in Antigone to mean singular gallbladder. And in the other 21 uses of coli, they don't refer to a gallbladder or gallbladders, but to bodily liquids. The gallbladder does have a role in divination. In both Aeschylus Prometheus Bound and Euripides Electra, the raw gallbladder is inspected after slaughter as part of this divination process. Aeschylus portrays Prometheus relating that he taught divination to men, including inspecting the organs after slaughter for the texture of the splanchna, color of the gallbladder, and appearance of the liver. And Euripides portrays Aegisthus inspecting the splanchna of a freshly slaughtered victim and the appearance of the liver, portal vein, and gallbladder, which indicate bad omens for him. And in both these examples, the gallbladder is grouped with the liver for examination when raw in order to look at its color and appearance. And the gallbladder can have different colors, as these five different lamb gallbladders show. I mean, they're all green, but they are different shades of green. And they all do have slightly different shapes. This one's shape is a little more aggressively different, but you can see they all are a little different, even though they're all oblong balloons of liquid. And you can see in these images how the liver and gallbladder are connected and get removed together. And here you can see you have to remove it. The gallbladder is attached to the liver and comes out with it. Potentially, the gallbladder gains some of its mantic value from this proximity to the liver. And this late 5th century statue from Mantinea, Arcadia, depicts a woman clearly holding a depicted liver with gallbladder attached. You can see the gallbladder. There are four passages I know of that seem to refer to a gallbladder being burned on an altar. In Euripides' Phoenician Women, when Polynices and Eteocles are being exhorted to battle by their respective sides, the seers sacrifice victims, and we read in a difficult-to-interpret passage that the seers observed the peaks of the fire and the burstings, the rhaxes, an unfavorable wetness, and the high flame, which portends two things, either victory or defeat. And things get interesting when we look at the scolia to this passage. For one scolion says that the burstings in this passage refer to how the seers look at the burstings of a gallbladder, and the seers watch how the gallbladders throw the wetness. So this scolion indicates that placing gallbladders on burning altars could be a component of sacrificial ritual, except in this passage, the gallbladder is expected to explode when put on the fire, and the seer observes how the liquid is then dispersed. And this seems quite different from the Antigone passage, in which the bursting at all is a bad omen. Another scolion to this passage, though, says that the passage refers to how the seers take a bladder whose mouth was tied shut with woolen thread and place it on the fire and watch how it breaks apart and where it throws the pee. And the bladder, right there, comes out right away. Yeah, it's easy to remove, and it is full of liquid, and you could tie it off and place it on an altar, and I assume it would explode and throw pee everywhere. I did not test this one, though. Let it go. And the divination here is derived from watching a liquid-filled organ explode. So we have contrasting interpretations in the scolia to this passage, and even the one that seems to shine light on the Antigone passage implies a gallbladder placed on an altar would be expected to explode. And so this makes the Antigone passage more, not less confusing. So let's return to our literary examples. In Menander's Discolos, the grumpy old man, Kinemon, laments the lack of piety of the people in his day, including that they offer to the gods the osphus and the gallbladder, because these are inedible. And they eat the rest, and since that tailbone, that osphus, is roasted on the altar, this seems to imply that the gallbladder was as well. Two passages in Plutarch refer to times one doesn't burn a gallbladder on an altar, which would imply that one does burn the gallbladder at other times. In Advice to Bride and Groom, Plutarch writes, "Those sacrificing to wedding Hera do not ritually burn the gallbladder with the rest of the sacred parts, but removing it, cast it by the altar." And in fragment 157.2, possibly from On the Festival of Images at Plataea, he says, possibly referencing the previous passage, "Again, at weddings, those sacrificing to Hera do not ritually burn the gallbladder, but they bury it by the altar." Interestingly, there are no examples on the Classical Greek Ritual Norms website of coli or any form of the word colē or synonym of colē, and no references to gallbladders that I could find in any sacred laws. All right, so let's return to that Antigone passage. Why would Sophocles use coli to mean one gallbladder when all these other sources use the singular colé to mean one gallbladder? So people have proposed that it was a metrical issue, but I find such arguments unsatisfying, as Sophocles was a very good poet who had control of the Greek language. Sophocles could have meant gallbladders, plural, as Griffith's 1999 Yellow and Green commentary translate the term. But in the narrative, Tiresias using the rites at the altar to double-check the inauspicious bird sign does not suggest the slaughtering of multiple animals. Perhaps Sophocles is using the plural for the singular form, as he sometimes does for body parts, or he has made a strange choice of word, like the choice of the prosaic word pimelis for fat in this passage. It's a word used only here in all poetry. So I tested it by roasting gallbladders on my experimental altar. Well, some liver does need to be removed with the gallbladder. It will rupture. And so I place these gallbladders on their liver bases in the fire. And this is going to work. All right. So watch this guy. What a dramatic bursting. It's very exciting. So can I show you one more? You don't think So I've done this four times. This one takes a little longer, but it's worth it. And this one is exciting because you want to watch on this gallbladder, we actually get to see the liquid boil, so you can see how it works. This is very exciting. We're running around with joy. That's what's going on right there. I'm so happy it worked. And then this third picture is one of the people helping me out here. He's showing one of the ones that exploded. I don't have a picture of it. Exploded, and a piece of it went that far. He's demonstrating how this is really dramatic explosions. All right. So let's go back to the LSJ in the Cambridge Greek Lexicon. Colé means a gallbladder or bile or gall liquid, and colix can be a synonym for colé, but can mean intestines. And the form colades can be a plural of colé or colix, but means intestines or offal always. So taking into account the Cambridge Greek Lexicon says that colades could be an alternate plural form for coli, the relationship to colé, to intestines or offal, perhaps seems much closer than previously realized. We might not have, in that coli here, is an coli is an alternate form of colades, is what I'm proposing. We might not have an exploding gallbladder in the Antigone passage. Instead, I'd like to suggest the Sophocles means exploding intestines or offal. And these are part of sacrificial ritual as part of the splankna. If intestines or splankna were what Sophocles meant by coli, then we would have two separate but related inauspicious omens at the burning altar. Similar to how Tiresias perceived two separate but related omens from the birds. Importantly, it would be as impossible for roasting splankna or the intestine component of splankna to explode high into the air as it would be for a fat-wrapped thigh bone to not catch fire. For both of these, then, divine intervention would be required. Okay, thank you for going with me on a deep dive into gallbladders. Let's return to splankna as a whole. The splankna are roasted at the altar, and I do believe it's at the same time as the fat-wrapped thigh bone is roasted and the tail curls, as pictured in these images. While images of sacrificial ritual on vases could depict splankna being roasted on an altar, could depict splankna being roasted on an altar while the tails and thigh bones burn as narrative compression, my experiments show that the splankna take about the same amount of time to cook as the fat-wrapped thigh bone takes to give off its distinct burst of flame and the tail takes to curl, and I believe it all happened at once for increased dramatic effect, religiosity. My next question, though, is what is on these sticks? Exactly. We all say splankna, but what exactly is being portrayed there? How do we get those onto those? Well, is it like this, Kokoretsi? Some people have proposed, is it like Kokoretsi? There's a problem, which is organs wrapped in lamb intestine and slowly roasted in grease. This is a dream come true. Also, they put pieces of omentum fat all throughout it, which I love. So it's got all the pieces. You're thinking, oh, maybe it's this. But the problem is, as you can see of this raw one to this one that's been cooking all day, is it takes all day to cook. And so you wouldn't be able to do the timing I was just talking about. It couldn't be. Also, You can't use the intestines from the animal you just used, as I discussed earlier. You have to clean them. So you would have to have ready intestines waiting by, and that's something that could go wrong. And I think we would all agree, you do it so it works. You're not going to have something that could risk go wrong, like, I ran out of intestines. What are we going to do today? Okay, so I don't think it's this. The question is then, do you chop this up into smaller pieces or put them on whole? In my experiments, they really cook faster and more evenly when cut up. And here's everyone loves to do this part, okay? Everybody wants to roast and eat the organs. It really only takes that same 6 to 15 minutes to roast when they're already cut up. I think we have to conclude that our vase painters are more concerned with the abstract representation of splankna rather than some clear depiction of the splankna. Which leads me to a quick detour of an aspect of these splankna roasting scenes that the artists do seem to be very careful about. And that's that I think each of these is an erotic scene. And I think that that's what the artist is most concerned about. Let's look. Each of these images contains a bearded man and a beardless youth making eye contact over the altar. Eye contact. And this guy's looking back to make eye contact with him. Sultry eye contact, if I might even push it so far. All right? And each of these images, this suggests to me an Erastes-Eramenos relationship perhaps being established across the altar at this religious moment. One is reminded of New Comedy and Roman comedies derived from New Comedy in which the erotic aspects of festivals are referenced. Maybe I pushed it too far, but as you look at these images, it's hard to unsee it once you've seen it, okay? So keep an eye out. But now let's return to the carcass. Once you've removed all the organs, it's now time for butchery, which is what I told you 18 pages ago I'd actually work on. So my apologies, it took a while. All right, so the first step is to cut the carcass down the spine. And one has to be careful to start wide of the tail and cut diagonally to the spine, and then start going down the spine to keep the tail whole and undamaged for the rites at the altar. We know that this method of going down the spine lengthwise was used in the ancient world because spine fragments look like this that are found in archaeological sites. All right. At this point, once the animal is cut into half, each half is then cut into 5 to 7 what we call primal cuts, according to the natural divisions of the muscles and bones. At this point, I want to return to Plato's Maieros from earlier. Two passages indicate that our Maieros is understood to have worked with the whole animal. In The Statesman, the dialogue at one point discusses dividing a complex problem like a Maieros does in the dividing a complex problem like a Maieros does a sacrificial carcass. And he then divides the problem into two halves and divides each half into roughly 5 cuts, just like the carcass into 5 primal cuts per side. In the Phaedrus, Socrates says an orator should be able to, quote, cut a speech up again form by form according to its natural joints and not try and break any part into pieces like an inexpert butcher, a brilliant description to me of taking half a carcass into its primal sections, primal cuts. From here, the next step is to divide the primal cuts into subprimals. Do see, so what's going on here is you've got, these are your primals, and this is just that half an animal flipped over. And then these are the subprimals that would be derived from it. For butchering hot cut meat, I do want to note, returning to hot cut meat, I know it's been 19 pages, but that's what we began with, right? Hot cut meat, everyone's with me. The meat is very sloppy, okay? It's very soft and almost gelatinous to the touch compared to meat that's passed through rigor. And it's so sloppy, in fact, that the butcher I initially worked with, Sarah Shub, initially refused to do this project with me as she felt that working with the carcass before rigor was too dangerous due to this meat texture. This soft meat inclines one to cut the meat into larger chunks and avoid detail work with the knife. So where the skinning stage pointed towards smaller knives, hot cutting points to larger knives for safety concerns and ease. We now return to the same stress factors that affected the treatment of the animal before slaughter to make a calm, auspicious slaughter. The stress the animal feels before slaughter doesn't just affect animal behavior, it affects the meat in a clearly perceptible way. Exposure to pre-slaughter stresses affects the speed and extent of pH drop post-mortem, and meat scientists regard ultimate pH and speed of pH drop as the key indicators of meat quality today. In short, the lamb meat drops from a pH of 7.2 at slaughter to 5.8 in roughly 8 hours. If the final pH is too high or if the drop is too quick, then the meat shows the pre-slaughter stress in three clear ways: water holding capacity, color, and texture. The most important stress-caused issue for lamb, goat, and beef is called dry, firm, and dark meat, or colloquially, dark cutting. Dark cutting is caused by chronic exposure to pre-slaughter stresses that result in an ultimate pH of over 6. Dark cutting results in meat that is darkly colored, you knew that was coming, abnormally firm and sticky to the touch. And this means that the pre-slaughter stress would be clearly perceivable by not just the Maiiros, but everyone there. The color of the meat would be too dark. The firmer meat would appear to have shrunk from the size you thought the animal was and have a smaller yield, and the texture would be deeply off to the touch. The resultant meat would be tough, much tougher than expected, and additionally, dark cutting meats have a higher susceptibility to microbial spoilage, which could result in sickness for the festival attendees who ate it. Importantly for our ancient herds, pasture-fed animals are more susceptible to dark cutting, meaning that ancient herds would have been more susceptible than modern animals on industrial farms fed or finished with grain-based diets. Another less common but possible stress-caused outcome in lamb and goats is a condition most commonly seen in pigs called pale, soft, and exudative, PSE. From a too rapid drop in pH drop caused by pre-slaughter stresses combined with too high a carcass temperature after slaughter. In this situation, the meat looks abnormally light in color, has an exceptionally gooey texture, and it oozes liquid all the time. Again, these would be clearly perceptible changes to the meat for anyone there caused by pre-slaughter stress. So the point here being that the same factors of stress reduction that made for a richly auspicious slaughter would also have a tangible and perceptible effect on the meat. So a stressed animal at slaughter, indicating an auspicious slaughter, would be perceived in the meat itself when you went to consume it or work with it. And it seems to me like this would cause a feedback loop that would then shape the treatment of the animal before slaughter to avoid this appearance in the meat. So suggested stress-reducing activities by Temple Grandin, such as taking the animal for a walk before slaughter, which brings to mind taking the animal for a walk as part of all sacrificial ritual, having the shepherd the animal new present, touching the animal on its shoulders, and picture here, I should have had pictures of it, but picture the scenes from the Acropolis frieze. They're touching the animal on the shoulders, right? They're doing these things. And restricting vision and the method of slaughter all serve to shape the appearance, texture, and taste of the meat. So I want to imagine that the steps of the ritual evolved in time, shaped by the appearance of the meat as the indicator of divine approval. Since the whole ritual is designed to succeed, to be auspicious, then it makes sense that the steps for the ritual developed in a way to cause the meat to look as ideal as possible. Well, now that we've cut up the meat, it's time to cook it. Cooking hot-cut meat is so rare in the United States that the shepherds I work with thought that cooking hot-cut meat would not work and would be inedible. And after the first time I did this, they came up afterward and were like, we all had a meeting and we thought this would fail. We're amazed it worked, right? They're so happy. But they really didn't believe you could hot-cut meat. That's how rare it is in the United States. There is a direct relationship of meat cooking and eating to the early onset of rigor, with the meat becoming tougher as rigor starts to set in. However, anecdotally, rigor comes on in my experiments more slowly than meat science textbooks would indicate. And this makes sense to me, as the studies are conducted at industrial abattoirs and ancient sacrifice was done at smaller scale and incorporates the stress mitigating factors that Temple Grandin recommends. However, that said, I have not yet tracked pH drop in the meat, but I have now acquired the equipment to do so, and I will start this year to be able to track it as proxy. So hopefully I'll be back next year, and I'll give you the results. Interestingly, meat that has not fully passed through rigor, and maybe you guys know this, have tasted this, it has a recognizably tough texture and an underdeveloped flavor that in kitchens we call green. There's a specific texture and flavor of meat that hasn't fully passed out of rigor called green. And that's something that we know about, but we don't really know the effects of pre-rigor on meat. They're less understood because hot cutting is so rare. That's something we're still trying to figure out. Without question, though, dark cutting or PSE meat would taste noticeably bad to the diners. So the pre-slaughter stress would affect the taste and texture of the meat for eating. Let's move more to cooking. So people think of steak now, in my experience, as preferable to stew. This continues the stuff you were just talking about. But my experiments show the opposite, which is what you were just arguing for. And in response, I've moved to stewing more of the meat each year. So we see images on vases of the people putting the meat on these huge spits. And this really has to be cattle meat, beef, because lamb and goats just don't have large areas of muscle large enough to make these lumps. It just doesn't exist on a lamb. It has to be cattle. And your next option would be roasting pieces on a direct fire or small spits. But the final and the most desirous way to do this is stewed. And so in my experiments on this, for the stew recipe, I wanted something that has a final texture that is thick enough to be satisfying. You don't just want like a bowl of water, right? But also not need to be stirred, as high maintenance cooking over an open fire is onerous. I wanted to keep it as simple as possible to not seem to be unduly influencing the stew with modern cooking techniques. So what I do is two parts meat. So every 2 kilograms of meat, I use 1 kilogram of wine, 2 to 1. And then a little bit of onion and salt, grant me that. And it results in a delicious stew with an ideal texture that one would want to use here if people are eating it. And appearance, you might think it needs more liquid, but absolutely does not. This is what you'd need, all right? And one sees this preference for stew in the late Bronze Age evidence with 14-liter stew pots for feasts for hundreds of kilos of beef, indicating a special status for the stew eaters. And in Herodotus, you see it where Croesus, the richest man in the world, seems to be cooking an entire sacrifice in stew pots, where he had options to do whatever he wanted. I believe that the large spits depicted here were used when there was too much beef for the available capacity of the pots. We were talking this inscription today. There's 35 pots, and we were saying each one had a capacity of 15 liters, so you got 10 kilograms of meat per each, so you've got 300 kilograms of meat right there. Well, that's only one cow. So even if you had 2 cows, you would need 300, you'd need to use these spits just on size. Perhaps the early onset of rigor is making the meat tough for roasting, and the stewing makes for a more tender real meal, or maybe lamb cuts are just better stewed. Well, although the focus of this paper is supposed to be on the meat is all in the service of the larger sacrificial ritual of which it's part, and I still want to address the rituals at the altar very briefly. So one has the fat-wrapped thigh bones, the tails, and the splankna to roast on the altar. And to my great happiness and surprise at my experiments, everyone loves these rituals, and they're really the high point for everyone, even though they don't actually believe in Demeter and Kore, which our festivals do. So I want to show you the tail curling, if that's all right to show a video of this. And what I want to show you here before it begins, I guess, is this is it. I've left the tuft of hair on the end to make it really visible. Okay, you wouldn't necessarily. I just did it to make it look good for you, to look. What I want you to see here is it's already been going on for a few minutes, and the tail seems to be curling the wrong way. And that's the stress involved. So even though it's always going to work, you do have this few minutes in the beginning where it seems to go the wrong way, and everyone's panicking. But then the rest, this isn't sped up at all. This is real time. So you can get a sense of how exciting it is. Yeah, it's so fast. It's so exciting. You can get everyone around it, and there's just those couple of minutes. So just to get a sense, it's not an all-day event. This really is some type of communal release every time when this ritual succeeds, even though you know it's going to happen. The sense of it starting to fail really seems to get everybody. And while I often seem to think of this kind of ritual in the ancient world is, I don't know if you guys have this, but students in the United States are always saying that they want to be seen and want to be heard, and this is the opportunity of the gods actually just said, I saw you and heard you. I tend to think that happened in the ancient world, but even if you don't believe in the gods, the effect it seems to have on everyone present is really striking, so maybe there are other factors in play. Well, the ancient festival was an incredible moment where people were brought together for community. And the rituals at the altar also brought contact with the gods. The clearly perceptible results of pre-slaughter stress on the meat would help shape the steps of the ritual to make for as good meat as possible. And thus, animal and man came together to, if I may, touch the void, the cosmic unknown, and have an opportunity to communicate directly with the divine. Thank you.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.